Okay, so I think things are settling down, so that's good. Some people are coming in, some people are leaving, some people are staying put, which is great. So now we can start this evening's talk, and tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about religion and secularism and the idea on how these two things interact, religion on the one hand, secular ideas on the other. And in particular, I'm going to focus on where does Buddhism, of course, fit into this? Is Buddhism, is it a secular thing? Is it a religious thing? And in particular, there is this one trend in the Western world that has arisen over the last few decades, perhaps, called secular Buddhism, and to have a look at that and whether that is, you know, in my opinion, any need for that? Is Buddhism already secular enough, or do we need some special thing called secular Buddhism or not? And as we go through this, of course, we'll have a look at a few of the kind of crucial Buddhist ideas and try to understand those in this context. One of the interesting things about the Buddhist teachings, which is always very fascinating, and which I recommend you to look at a little bit if you have a chance, and that is to understand a little bit about Buddhist history. Right? When you understand Buddhist history, you understand some of the things that how this teaching, this Buddhist teaching, is not a static thing, but it's something which always changing, depending on the time period, depending on the country where it goes, right? It's always floating, always changing, always metamorphosizing, or whatever it is, from one thing into another one, always changing, moving from one thing to something else. And this is the history of Buddhism. And you see that especially when it goes from one country to another one. You see the Buddhism in China is different from the Buddhist in Sri Lanka, which is different from the Buddhism in Thailand, right? And then you have Japan, and all of these things are slightly different. But not only that, it's also about just time progressing. When, as time goes on, Buddhism changes by its nature as well. And one of the reasons for that is simply the restlessness of the human mind, right? We can't just accept the teachings as they are. We have to try to figure them out in a deeper way, to think about them, systematize them in new ways, change things a little bit to our own liking. And by doing that, what happens is that you get these entirely new scriptures created, which had nothing really to do with the original teachings. And gradually, as time goes by, there is a change in outlook, a change in philosophy, a change in psychology as time goes by. Gradually things are changing. So this is what happens to Buddhists. This is what Buddhist history is in a large part about, that movement, that change on this thing we call Buddhism. And of course, one of the great things when Buddhism comes to a new country, like coming to Australia or coming to the Western world more generally, is that you have a chance to reappraise what actually is the essence of these teachings. What are the accretions that have accumulated over the centuries and millennia? What belong to a certain culture, but not actually to the teachings that the Buddha gave us and bequeathed us 2,500 years ago? It's a great opportunity to do that. It's much more difficult to do that in a Buddhist country because of the weight of history, right? The weight of tradition, often very, very hard to go against. But when it starts in a new country, we have that opportunity. And this is one of the great things that we can actually look for as Buddhism comes to Australia and the Western world. What actually is the essence of this? So this is the one side of the coin, right? But there's another side of that coin, and that is the understanding, as I just mentioned before, whenever Buddhism goes to a new place, a new society, a new culture, a new era, Buddhism itself gets influenced by that new society. And of course, when Buddhism comes to the West, exactly the same thing is going to happen. Buddhism itself is going to be formed according to our Western ideas. Our Western history, our Western culture is going to have an impact on that Buddhism, just as Buddhism has an impact on us. It's a two-way street, right? Both things working on each other. And of course, when something gets influenced like that, we have to be very careful. Because when something gets influenced like that, it can get influenced in the wrong way. And if it does get influenced in the wrong way and you end up with a teaching that is completely contradictory to the insights the Buddha had 2,500 years ago, you could end up throwing out the baby. Okay, throw out some of the dirty bathwater, but keep the baby for goodness sake. So we have to be very careful when we make these shifts from one historical period to another, from one culture to another, that we don't throw out the essence of these teachings. We don't throw out something which is so foundational that Buddhism doesn't really function anymore if you throw it out. And this is one of these trends in Western society now, is precisely this thing that is called secular Buddhism. And I think some of the ideas in secular Buddhism are actually very good and are incredibly useful. But I think some of the other ideas risk diluting Buddhism to the point where you don't really have Buddhism at all anymore. It's not secular Buddhism, it becomes just secular, right? With a little bit dash of Buddhism on top, like a little bit of, you know, a little bit of, I don't know what, some little bit of sprinkling of something. And that is not really enough. In that case, we end up destroying what this is all about. So to understand this, understand a little bit more about the idea of secularism and religion, I think it's always good to look a little bit at history. There's often a lot to be learned from history, and to understand what is the context in which the idea of secularism actually arose. Once you understand that context, it's much easier to see if it applies to Buddhism or not. And of course, that context, as many of you probably will have some idea about already, is of course this is what arose in Europe. In Europe, after the Middle Ages, you had the Renaissance and you had the Enlightenment. Right? Enlightenment. This is pretty shallow kind of enlightenment compared to the Buddhist enlightenment, right? And this is one of the reasons I don't really like that word enlightenment, because enlightenment tends to refer to that re-arising of kind of science and critical thinking in Europe after the darkness of the Middle Ages. In Buddhism, we should use other terms, I think, otherwise it gets confused. So I like awakening in Buddhism. But anyway, at that time in Europe, come through the dark Middle Ages that were very repressive, where state and religion were kind of completely mixed, where the Pope was sitting in Rome and controlling pretty much all of Europe, when you had the Inquisition, they were burning books and burning people at the stake and telling people what they could think and what they couldn't think. And then came the Renaissance, and things started to change, right? You had the very first scientists of the Renaissance, people like Copernicus, who said that actually the earth goes around the sun, not the sun going around the earth. And the church, what? What are you saying? And then, of course, Galileo came along, and Galileo was even more strong about this point of view. And Galileo was actually one of the great scientists of the modern era. And he had, I don't know all that much about him, but he had a lot of various scientific theories that later on proved to be very accurate. But of course, he, you know, looked through his telescope, he saw the moons around Jupiter and Saturn and all this kind of stuff. And he also, of course, supported the Copernican idea that the Earth actually revolves around the sun. And the church said, heretics, you can't say that. And they locked Galileo up in the house for 30 years, whatever it was, because he dared to say that the earth revolved around the sun. Wow, whoa, that is really bad, right? How can you say that the earth goes around the sun? Now, it seems so obvious, but in those days, it was a dramatic heretical teaching from the point of view of the Catholic Church. It's pretty madness when you look at it from a modern point of view, but that's what it was like. That was what the atmosphere was like at that time. And of course, then, soon after the scientific revolution started to happen, people were saying that, well, actually, we don't really want to have this interference from the church. We want to run our state, our countries, independent of these dogmas, these ideas that are just handed down, that have no connection to reason, to science, to logical thinking. Why should we be held back by these church ideas that actually don't have any basis in reality? And that is where the idea of secularism arose. We should have a state independent of the church. And that was one of those beginnings in Europe of the independence of state and church. So what seems the most obvious thing here about secularism, the most obvious thing that it was counteracting was not religion as such, but it was a particular aspect of religion. And that aspect of the religion that was problematic was the dogma, right? The narrow-mindedness, the inability to inquire, to ask questions, to move forward. That was really the problem. And that was where things stopped. And I think once you understand that, you understand why this word religion also has been so problematic in the modern world. Because the word religion has always been associated with dogma, with narrow-mindedness, the inability to see truth when it's staring you in the face, right? Instead, just close your eyes because we want the truth to be this particular way. And that is really the problem. And that is why the secularist movement arose. So the question that we really need to ask as Buddhists is, well, is Buddhism so dogmatic that we need this kind of secular view? Or is it perhaps the case that Buddhist ideas are very much aligned with some of these secular ideas? Maybe that is the case instead. And I'm going to argue and I'm going to point out to certain aspects of the Buddhist teaching that actually, of course, Buddhism can be dogmatic as well, just like anything in the world can be dogmatic. But the early Buddhism, the Buddhism of the Buddha, right? The Buddha started it all out, was actually an inquiring teaching, looking into things, an open-mindedness, trying to find radical solutions to real problems of human existence. I've always wondered what kind of person was the Buddha. You know, I mean, obviously he was kind of a little bit Hindu. In those days, it wasn't really Hinduism the way it is now. He grew up in that kind of society, was obviously very affected by those teachings. But if you wanted to categorize him, right, as a in terms of religion, what kind of religion did he belong to? And sometimes I wonder, maybe the Buddha was an atheist. Right? Maybe he was an atheist. Maybe he kind of would have sided with Richard Dawkins or something in the present day here. Maybe actually that is going too far, because I don't think that is quite true. But I think what the Buddha really was, it's kind of nice to think of the Buddha as an atheist, but what I think the Buddha really was, he was the agnostic. He said, I don't know. I am unsure, right? I have an open mind. I don't really know what's going on. I am going to find out for myself. And that, of course, that agnosticism is something that also is very quite common in the present day world. You say there is uncertainties there. There are mysteries in the world beyond what I can understand right now. So I'm going to keep an open mind. And that, I think, is what the Buddha really was. The problem here is then dogmatism, right? Holding on to ideas, grasping onto things, not letting them go, not being able to be open-minded. That is the real problem. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that dogmatism is something that you don't just find it in religion. Okay, religion tends often to be particularly bad, perhaps, when it comes to dogma. But dogma is something you find everywhere in society. Right? Sometimes you find dogmatism. Dogmatism sometimes just expresses itself in certain fads and trends. Sometimes you get fads within medical science. You get fads within in management, right? You have to manage people in this way. This is the right way of doing it. You get fads in what kind of clothes you have to wear. And very often these fads are very similar to dogmas. They are things that you cannot really... It's very hard. There's a plurality of people that look at things in a certain way, and because they do that, it's very hard to break out of that. So when you start to think like that, when you start to look at the world, there's this fads going on anywhere, there's dogmas, and you start to see that it is very pervasive. It is something that you find everywhere. It is not just confined to religion. You find it in politics, of course, right? Dogmatic, holding certain views just because those views, you always have them, so you're going to keep on to them or whatever. And of course, what is interesting also, it is also found in science itself. Science also, even though the idea of science is to be open-minded, to be inquiring, always searching for the truth, science also sometimes falls into the problem of dogma. And there was a very interesting book that was written back in the 1960s. It was very influential, I think, in the history of science. It was called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And basically has been agreed upon as a proper description how science actually develops over time. And what this book argued is that science gets stuck in certain ways of looking at the world, this thing they call paradigms, a certain paradigm, a certain way of a certain outlook. And you get stuck in that outlook, and then evidence accumulates against this outlook. More and more evidence accumulates. Everybody just dismisses it, doesn't want to see it, until the evidence becomes so strong that you no longer can avoid looking at the new evidence. And then there is what they call a paradigm shift, and you move into another worldview, another way of looking at things, right? This is how he showed that science kind of progresses. And of course, what you're seeing there, you're seeing a degree, it's a degree of dogmatism that happens as that certain view is accepted over time. So even in science, right, which is supposed to be the most open part of one of the most open institutions in the human sphere. So why is it? Why is it that we find dogmas everywhere? What is the reason for that? And the answer is very simple. The answer is basically because dogmas are part of who we are. We cannot exist without dogmas. Each one of us has views. Each one of us has certain ways of looking at the world. And this is part of our personality, part of who we take ourselves to be. If somebody challenges your views, this is when you find out whether you are attached to your views or not, right? And sometimes you realize, I am attached to my views. In fact, it is impossible that you should not be at least a little bit attached to the views you have. This is part of human experience. And it comes from the very basic sense of self that we all carry with us. The sense of self that you have inside of you, that you exist, that you are a certain person, you have a certain character, you have a certain way of doing and looking at things, that sense of self demands a content. It demands an identity. It demands something to fill it up, to make it real. And part of that which makes the sense of self real is our views, the way we look at the world. So of course, if somebody challenges your views and you take them to be the very who you are, right? You can't just give it up, because if you give it up, it is as if you are giving up your very existence, your very sense of self, who you actually are, your atta, we would say in Pali. And because of that, you have to hold on to those views. It's impossible to be completely open-minded. It cannot be done unless you are fully awakened or something like that, right? And you're way up there on the spiritual path. Apart from that, it is impossible to be completely open-minded. You have to have some things that you hold on to. And now, of course, you can understand why dogmatism is so rife, why it has to exist everywhere, because it comes from the very core, the very sense of who we are as human beings. Right? That's where it comes from. And of course, that is going to infiltrate all human institutions wherever you go, whether it is science, as I was just saying, whether it's religion, whereas any the Buddhist society here, right? We're probably dogmatic. Are we dogmatic, Drew? Probably. Yes, we are dogmatic. So there you are. So you see, so it's everywhere. Right? He should know. He's the president. So he has kind of polled everyone. He knows what everyone is thinking. So it's everywhere, and it is absolutely unavoidable that it should exist to some extent. So this is the first thing to realize. So it is no surprise that it should also be found in religion. It's no surprise that it should also be found in Buddhism, right? Has to be found everywhere. So that is one side of the coin. Now the other side of the coin is, let us look at some of those Buddha's teachings and see whether they fit in with the idea of dogmatism. This is the other side. And what my point is going to be to show you that these basic Buddhist teachings, these basic aspects of Buddhism, actually are not dogmatic. They are dogmatic only because we make them dogmatic. But as they were explained by the Buddha himself, as we find them in the earliest discourses of Buddhism, they're not actually dogmatic. Now, the first thing I just look at very briefly is the idea of Buddhist ethics. Right? If you look at the large number of systems of ethics around the world, ethics can often be a sphere of dogma. Right? These are the things you have to follow, and if you don't follow those, you will go to hell. Right? That becomes dogmatic. So ethics can very easily become a system of a dogmatic system. But actually, that is not really the case in the Buddhist teachings. Of course, in Buddhism too, that can happen. But if you go back to the root teachings, go back to what we know with a fair amount of certainty was the word of the Buddha himself, you find a very different approach to ethics. In fact, I would always say that to me, the Buddhist ethics is one of the jewels of Buddhism. It is one of the jewels because it is incredibly flexible and very movable. It is not something that is rigid and fixed, but it can be used and applied, if it is done properly, in any kind and used for any kind of context, to use it for modern ethical problems, etc. It can be used for all of that, which is wonderful because actually that's quite rare for a religion. And of course, Buddhist ethics is also very beautiful because it is very comprehensive. It is about how we speak, right? Don't say bad things. Try to say kind things. It's about how we act. Act in kind ways with compassion. Don't act in harsh ways. And also, it is about how we think, right? So incredibly comprehensive. This is one of the beauties about the Buddhist morality. But the other thing about Buddhist morality, it is based on what I would consider a very rational system. It is not based on the thou shalt not system at all. It is based on something rational. It's not handed down by the Buddha. It says, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. No, the Buddha says there is a way of looking at ethics which is rational. And that is to ask the very simple question. Right? What is one of the most essential aspects of the human beings? And one of the most essential aspects of human beings, actually not just humans, animals too, any kind of being really. One of the things that defines us as beings is that we feel. Right? Things tend to be either pleasurable or not pleasurable, either painful or happy, suffering or blissful. There is this dichotomy in our experience of the world. And this is one of the most important aspects of human beings, because this is what drives us in the world. This is what gives rise to cravings and desires. This is what kind of moves us all the time. This sense that we want to move towards greater sense of ease, happiness, pleasure, peace, all these positive things, less suffering, less pain, less problems, less of all this negative stuff. So very, very, very essential, maybe the most essential aspect of human beings. Consciousness too, of course, being very important. Actually, it's hard to say what is most important, but certainly very significant. And from that, you can derive ethics directly. Because we know that people recoil from pain, recoil from negative experiences and they want the positive experiences, then of course ethics is the very simple thing that if you act to people in such a way that they get more of the happy experiences, less of the painful ones, then it's ethical. If you act towards others, they get more pain and less pleasure, it's unethical. Right? It's very simple. It's based on who we are as human beings. And on that framework, on that basis, the whole edifice of Buddhist ethics is based on that. So if you want to ask some of those difficult ethical questions that you always hear, things about abortion, things about euthanasia, things about climate change, all of these things, right? You can take it back to that, and you can base it on that, and you can answer pretty much all of these questions based on that very simple framework. So all of these things, they don't have any pre-described answers in Buddhism. The answers come out from the logical system of Buddhism itself, how it actually works. So this is the first thing about Buddhism, right? There's no dogma there, really. It's based on the thoroughly rational idea of how ethics is supposed to work. So this is my first example. Second example. So no need for secularity, right, in ethics. There's nothing about this ethical framework I have said that is really either religious or secular. It is not none of those. It's just an ethical, rational ethical framework which transcends the idea of religion and secularism. This is kind of the nice thing, right? You can transcend these things. You can kind of marry them together and go beyond. That's when you find something larger, something greater, which is always very nice. The second thing is the idea of meditation. Is meditation, is that secular or is it religious? Right, so what is meditation all about? Meditation is about having some kind of inner experience, an inner experience which makes you feel more at ease, more relaxed, more peaceful. Sometimes you can experience powerful, powerful bliss in meditation. I know that many of you who are here have done that because you've been there, done those meditation retreats, and you have had some of those experiences. And you know how transforming it can be to have these kind of experiences. It's as if you're lifted out of the world and you see something new, something different that you had no idea actually existed before. Right? It's a very, very, very important part of the spiritual path, the meditation experiences, because it gives you access to something higher. It gives you access, basically. People who have been there and done that, they say it gives you access to what feels like the meaning of life itself. So pretty, very, very powerful stuff. So what is this? Is it, first of all, is it real? Well, it is real. People are obviously experiencing these things, right? They're obviously there. Not only are they experienced in Buddhism, they are experienced in Christianity. Some of the Christian saints of the Middle Ages, the Middle Ages again, right? It wasn't all dark. Some of the Christian saints actually experienced these blissful experiences during those Middle Ages. A famous Catholic nun in Spain called Teresa of Avila was very famous for entering this inner chambers of bliss she was talking about, and sounds very similar to the Buddhist ideas of samadhi, deep meditation experience. So it existed in Christianity, right? It certainly existed in Hinduism. Hinduism is famous for the samadhi sages, the sages that go into samadhi. Very famous Hindu sage, Ramana Maharshi, who lived in the 1950s or thereabouts. Very famous in India. You can find books about him on the internet now. And he lived in this little concrete hut, right, with a kind of single light bulb hanging down from the ceiling. The kind of classic kind of, kind of outback place was incredibly simple. There's a single bulb hanging down, glaring light, everything is concrete. Terrible, right? This kind of place nobody would ever want to live. And he would sit there on the concrete. All he had was a loincloth. Otherwise, he was completely naked apart from this loincloth. And he would sit there all day, just smiling, just so happy, just blissing out all the time. And all these people would come to him and pay respects to him because he was so special, right? And he was one, when he occasionally talked, then it was clear that he was one of these people who had access to very profound samadhi. He had done some kind of death contemplation when he was young, and through that death contemplation, he was able to access this state that was completely otherworldly. And from then on, he would just sit there, meditate, in this simple concrete hut with a single light bulb, and he sat there for year after year, decade after decade. Would you enjoy that? There's nothing else in the world that he wanted to do, right? Isn't that quite astonishing in a sense? And this is the astonishing thing about these attainments, is that you live in a way that nobody else can comprehend, and yet you are probably one of the very happiest people on this planet. So these things are there. Hinduism, Christianity, certainly very important in Buddhism. Other religions too sometimes talk about accessing these powerful states of ecstasy, which probably also are states of samadhi. So again, if you're an atheist, right? Sometimes atheists access these things. It doesn't matter if you believe in God or you believe in the Buddha, you believe in whatever, believe in Thor. I'm Norwegian by birth. Sometimes I think I have this Thor and Odin are kind of deeply seated inside of me. Now, I always wondered if you pray to Thor, maybe you can actually experience these kind of states as well, right? And maybe you hear some thunder, forward the thunder, bang, and then you go into this blissful state. I don't know, it's an interesting idea. I think probably if you practice in the right way, right, it doesn't really matter so much what kind of religious background you come from. I'm not really sure if I will ever go back to those, Thor and Odin, but anyway, it's an interesting idea that even there may be access to those things. Maybe the battles they had in heaven are some kind of metaphor for deep states of meditation. I don't think so. I think it's pretty violent and bad stuff. Anyway, it is a universal human experience. Is it religious? Is it secular? And the answer is neither. Anyone can actually attain these things, right? And of course, if you ask a secular Buddhist, or rather those people who call themselves secular Buddhist, they will agree. They will say, well, these are universal states. Of course, they are neither religious nor secular. So that is the meditation side of things, right? And there's no dogma there. One of the beautiful things about this is that the deeper your meditation is, the more deep your samadhi is, the less dogmatic you tend to become. Some of the most beautiful people you will ever meet in the world are the people who have access to deep states of meditation. They are so full of kindness, so full of compassion, so full of peace. When you get into their presence, all you want to do is just sit down and relax, right? I can't remember whether I told this story here before. Maybe I have, but last year, actually it was earlier this year, I went to Thailand and I went to see one of these very famous monks in Thailand who is famous for having a lot of this loving kindness, metta, and all of these beautiful qualities. And when I met to meet him, he was just sitting there on his big chair, right? A small little monk sitting on his big chair, and just sitting there just smiling, right? Looking really blissed out, really, really happy. He didn't say anything, right? He was just sitting there. And just by sitting there, not by saying anything, all these people would come, and they would just sit down around him, as if they were sitting in this kind of force field of kindness, just feeling the goodness of being around this person. Right? It's quite astonishing, isn't it? And this is what it's like to be in the presence of people who have this kind of samadhi thing. And when you talk to them, you feel there is very undogmatic. There's very little adhering to views. And there's a lot of flexibility in the way they look at the world. They have no sense that they have anything to defend because they are complete in themselves. There's no external self that they have to prove anything. They don't adhere to anything anymore. So actually, here you can start to see that these samadhi experiences, instead of making you dogmatic, they tend to lead you away from dogmatism. Sometimes they can lead you to a dogma. Sometimes you can take those experiences to have certain meanings. But very often, they lead you away from dogmatism into a soft and open-minded and inquiring way of looking at the world. Very beautiful when you meet this kind of people. And then there is the last part of Buddhism that I wanted to just briefly talk about, and that is the insight or the wisdom aspect, the seeing things in according to reality. We're getting more and more closer and closer here to the core of Buddhism, what it actually really is, right? What the insights of the Buddha were truly about. So this is where we would expect to find the most dogmatic kind of statements, because it is the core, the essence of what these teachings are about. So what is that core? Well, one of the most important aspects, core insights of the Buddha, is this idea of non-self. Right? This idea that if you look inside of yourself and you investigate after a powerful state of samadhi, what you see is you see an ever-changing process of mental and physical phenomena moving on from one state to another one. Is that, what is that? Is that religious? Is it secular? And again, if it is an insight into who you are as a person, because you're looking at yourself with a powerful mind, looking at yourself in a neutral way, and of course many modern psychiatrists and whatever will agree with that view, although they haven't properly fully understood it, they will say similar kind of things. Again, it is not neither secular nor religious, right? It's just an insight into reality. That's what it is. And as an insight into reality, it is not really dogmatic. It's similar in some ways to scientific fact-finding by understanding reality, understanding the world as it actually is. And I should maybe this is a good opportunity to make an important distinction here. Sometimes in the modern world, you will hear, there will be psychologists or psychiatrists, they will say, yeah, we agree with the Buddha's teaching. You know, when we look at the human mind, there is no essence there, there is no core, there is no factor of personality, which is always unchanging, moving along, you know, from moment to moment, always the same. So we agree with Buddhism. So does that mean that these psychiatrists and psychologists have the same insight into the human mind as the Buddha had, or as modern meditators occasionally may have? Is that what it means? And the answer is not really, yeah. Because although you may be able to see that there is no core inside of me, although you can see that as a psychologist and psychiatrist, that is not the same as actually experiencing that. As long as it's something that you are observing from outside, it doesn't touch you in a deep way, and your sense of self will still be the same. The sense of self isn't challenged in a deep sense. It is only when you see these things inside of yourself, that is when that real sense of self is challenged, and that is why that insight you have on a meditation cushion is what really matters, and the intellectual view that you have as a psychologist is only a very superficial view of the same thing. The psychologist is not touched on a deep psychological level. The meditator, if he sees this, is transformed beyond recognition by having these kind of insights. So again, but I think we can agree at the very least that this is neither secular nor really religious. It's just about reality. Maybe it's not true. You might disagree with this Buddhist view, but certainly it is not really religious or secular. Now there's one other type of insight, and this is where we are moving into the terrain that some people will call dogmatic, right? Because one of the other profound insights that you normally have on the path to awakening is the insight that there is not just one life, but that there is such a thing as rebirth. Right, and this is the area which is kind of crucial, because this is the area where the so-called secular Buddhists will say, well, these are the things we need to throw out. This is the cultural baggage of Buddhism that has to be abandoned, and we need a more rational view of the world. But remember that from a Buddhist point of view, this is not a dogma. This is not something the Buddha says, I'm just putting it out there for you to believe in. No, this is a crucial, essential aspect of the Buddha's path to awakening itself. This is one of the insights he had into the nature of reality. Just like samadhi, deep meditation, is a real state. Just like the idea of non-self is something you can investigate and perhaps find out for yourself. In exactly the same way, the idea of rebirth is something that has been investigated, that has been inquired into by the Buddha and discovered by the Buddha. And as such, it is not neither secular nor religious. It is, from the Buddha's point of view, just a claim about the nature of reality, how the body and mind function over long, long periods of time. Right, and this is so important to understand. And once you see it this way, that even these things which people sometimes look upon as dogmas actually has got nothing to do with dogma at all. Of course, we can make it into a dogma. We can say, believe in rebirth or else, or burn at the stake, right? That would be something if we had believe in rebirth or burn at the stake. But are we going to do that, Drew? No, But that can happen. You can make these things into dogmas. But that, of course, is not the point. The point is the right way of approaching things like rebirth is not to make it into a dogma, but understand it. This is what the Buddha taught. Now let me inquire into it. Let me look at this. Let me have an open mind about this and see if what the Buddha said actually makes any sense. And that is the right attitude to have towards it. And then you are following in the footsteps of the Buddha, because that is exactly what he did. He inquired into this. He asked himself the question, is there rebirth? He found the answer was yes. And of course, once you found out, then you have no doubt about the issue anymore. So this is the right way. So there are, as far as I'm concerned, there aren't really any dogmas in Buddhism. What there is a person who claims to have discovered something extraordinarily profound. And then what we should do is look at those claims and see if they make any sense, right? And if we find that they make some sense, well then, at the very least, we should have an open mind about these things. If you reject outright what the Buddha said, well, basically, what you are doing, you are rejecting the awakening of the Buddha. And if you reject the awakening of the Buddha, then you cannot really call yourself a Buddhist. Not yet, anyway, until you move maybe a little bit further. And all of this is encapsulated very beautifully in a very famous sutta The suttas are the discourses of the Buddha. And this is a sutta known as the Kalama Sutta in the Buddhist canon. And this Kalama Sutta is very often quoted, especially in Buddhist secular circles, right? Because it is very similar to the way we like to look at the world in the present day. And in this Kalama Sutta, you see the Buddha, he's wandering around the country. This is in the north of India, 2,500 years ago. He's wandering around the Ganges plain from place to place, spreading his teachings, right? This is what he did when he was still quite young. And then one day, he arrives at a certain place. And this is the country of a group of people known as the Kalamas, right? So he comes to the Kalamas, and the Kalamas say to the Buddha, Master, or Blessed One, or whatever you want to call the Buddha, Venerable Sir, we are so confused, right? We don't know what to believe. One day, the one spiritual teacher comes to us, and he says A. Another day, another spiritual teacher comes, and he says negative A. He says the exact opposite of what the first one said. And then a third day, a third spiritual teacher comes, and he says B, right? So what are we to believe? These spiritual teachers are contradicting themselves. They are absolutely at odds with each other. We don't know what to believe. And then the Buddha replies, and this is one of those famous replies found in the suttas. It's not famous because it is really a core of Buddhism. It is famous because Western people like this kind of stuff. That's why it's famous in the West. Right? In Asia, it's not so important because Asia have a very different history, so these things don't come up quite in the same way. But in the West, wow, it fits in with secularism, right? And that sort of stuff, and that's why it becomes so famous. So then the Buddha says, one of the first things the Buddha says is that, well, you have doubts about a doubtful matter, right? You are right to have doubt. Which already is like, wow, you have the right to have doubt. Wow, that's really freeing, right? We don't actually have to kind of hold on to one dogma or something else. Sometimes there are things that are truly doubtful. And when things are really doubtful, it is right to have doubt about those things. So remember that. There's nothing to be ashamed about if you have doubt. You have to be honest about those things and then see what happens as you practice and you read and you do whatever, you come here, whatever you do. And then the second thing the Buddha says, which is this is kind of the crucial part of it. He says that don't go by tradition, right? Forget about tradition for a moment. Don't go by reasoning, right? By reasoning. This is one of the things that are very sacrosanct in the Western culture. But he says don't go by reasoning, at least for the moment. Don't go by faith in the teacher, right? If there's a teacher, don't go just because somebody is your teacher. Don't go by faith in that. Don't go by the competence of the teacher. Similar thing as going by faith in the teacher. Instead, what you should do, Kalamas, when you know that something is right, when you know that something is wholesome and it leads to happiness, when you know that something is blameless and it leads you away from suffering, then you should follow that as your leader. But when you know the opposite is true, something leads towards suffering, is to be blamed and is not considered good by wise people in the world, then you should not hold on to that and you should move away from that. Right? So what the Buddha is saying, that in the final analysis, in the final reckoning, the thing that we have to rely on in the end is our own experience. That is the most important thing. And of course, that harks back straight to what I was saying before. In the Buddha's own life, that's exactly what he did. He went out searching in the world. He found, he gave up all the teachings that were around him. He was an agnostic, perhaps an atheist, right? Don't tell anyone that I told you Buddha was an atheist, because they will get horrified if I say that. Maybe not here so much in Australia, but if you go to some Asian countries and the Buddha was an atheist, they will think, oh, this monk, we better get rid of him quickly, and, or something like that. But the Buddha was radical, right? And he looked at things on his own, and he is telling us, well, okay, I have awakened to the truth. I have seen what is going on, so I will tell you. But now is the time for you to investigate by yourself and see if you also find the same truth. So it comes back down, the final analysis. It is our own experience that matters. But remember, But the point here is that experience is very broad. It doesn't just mean the experience that you have when you close your eyes and you look inside of yourself. Sometimes that experience that you have when you close your eyes and you look inside of yourself is pretty, it's not very inspiring, right? It doesn't get you anywhere. All you see is this ramble of thoughts, right, going on, oh no. Or you feel tired, snoring away, right? It doesn't get you very far in terms of insight and understanding the human mind because you're just seeing all this stuff happening here. So there is more to human experience than just things that happen in meditation or looking at your mind in daily life. Part of that experience is also listening to other teachers. It's also listening to the Buddha. Right? When the Buddha says to the Kalamas, don't listen to the teachers, he's kind of contradicting himself, isn't it? Because he's not saying, don't listen to me. He's obviously saying, listen to me. So the point is context. The point is how this works together. Your experience should match also the listening with the teacher, should match also with rational thought. Of course, we have to be rational. We can't throw out rationality. That's not what the Buddha is saying. He's saying we should put these things together in the right way. Sometimes rationality doesn't work because it's based on the wrong assumptions. If you build up this massive philosophy, but the foundation is weak because the assumptions are wrong, then of course the whole thing collapses. So rationality is sometimes can be wrong. And that's why sometimes we need to go beyond that. And that is what the Buddha is talking about. And when you put all of those things together, that is when you get the system which starts to work. And when you can start to make wise decisions about what is right and what is wrong. So read the suttas, read the word of the Buddha, understand what it is about. One of the things the Buddha says is that there is such a thing as rebirth. Now, if you have strong confidence in the Buddha, conviction that he knew that what he was talking about, and this is one of the things that I have found in my life as a monk, been a monk for 21 years now, I love to read the word of the Buddha, and it gives me ever more confidence in the genius of this person called the Buddha, this spiritual genius who existed 2,500 years ago. If the Buddha says there is rebirth, I can't just reject it. I can't say the Buddha was wrong. Here is this towering figure, right? The father, the originator of this whole Buddhism has been going for 2,500 years. Who am I to say that he got it wrong? I don't know. That is the right attitude. I'm unsure. I'm uncertain. But at the very least, I should take this teaching seriously. And this is my challenge to those secular Buddhists. There isn't this distinction between secularism and religion, certainly not religion in the way the Buddha taught it. It is an artificial distinction once you start to look to break it down. So those secular Buddhists, the challenge to all of those is to look at what the Buddha taught. If you really are a Buddhist, as is implied in your name, secular Buddhist, you should take this teaching seriously. It is a responsibility to take this teaching seriously. And if you find, as I have found, and I can't see there's a smidgen of doubt about it, that the Buddha said there is rebirth, then you should have an open mind. If you don't have an open mind, if you reject it, then you have to ask yourself whether it really is appropriate to call yourself a Buddhist in the first place. May sound a bit harsh, but really, if you don't take the Buddha or have him been somebody special, have some special insight, then really, are you then a Buddhist? It's a very important question to ask. So we have to be careful here. If we're not careful, if we fashion Buddhism in the according to Western values and Western ideas, we have to be careful we don't throw out the baby. This baby is extraordinarily valuable. It has the ability to change our lives, move us away from suffering, give us more happiness, right? Challenge some of the core assumptions in our life, and along the way transform us into human beings with compassion, with kindness, with beauty inside, abandoning all those negative things in the world. And as we do that, as we transform ourselves, we also transform all the people that we come in contact with. We transform the society around us, and we have this ripple effect spreading out in society. very powerful, very beautiful. Let's not destroy that. Let's be very careful when we take Buddhism into the Western world, that we are honest about what the teachings of the Buddha really are. If not, we're going to do so much harm to this very, very powerful teaching, this wisdom teaching that was bequeathed by us, by the Buddha, 2,500 years ago. Let's be honest. Let's be careful. Let's be humble. And let's take care of it in the right way. Okay, that's it for tonight. Okay, so there you are. So that's a bit about various issues. So would anybody like to ask any questions or challenge me that secular Buddhism is right, perhaps, or whatever? We have one person over there. Let's just get the microphone. Hold on 1 second, please.
Thank you for tonight, Arjun. It's always beautiful. The meditation is always very blissful, and your talks are very interesting. And I have a question on touch, on human touch. To me, that's one of the basic needs of human beings. And I'm curious why different lineages of Buddhism, like the Tibetan Buddhists, they're actually affectionate. They touch you when you're speaking to them, when you're interacting with them, whereas your lineage does not touch. Yeah. So could you please speak about that, please?
Yeah. Okay, so you want me to touch you? Is that what you want? Okay. Well, the reason is, it's, a lot of it is just history, right? As always, history is very important in this. And one of the main reasons is that according to the monastic rules, it is an offense if for a monk to touch a woman, especially, not always, not in all circumstances, but if you touch a woman, especially if you have some desire for that woman, right? Oh, I really like this, I really like you, right? So if you come up here, if I touch you, it's a very bad thing for me to do from the monastic rules. And it is gender equal. It's the same thing for the nuns. The nuns cannot touch men in exactly the same way. And that's why we do that. In many circumstances, no problem. If I go out and somebody wants to shake my hand, a woman, I always shake a woman's hand, because obviously you're just doing it for shaking hands. If there has been an accident and you need to help somebody, of course, no problem whatsoever. But you have to be careful, because, and this is one of the reasons we don't do that, because it very easily can go too far in one direction. The reason why the Tibetans don't do that is because the Tibetan history of Buddhism is very, very different. They don't follow those rules in the same way that we do. And that is basically why you have that distinction. But, you know, it doesn't mean I don't like you, right? We don't touch you. It doesn't mean I don't have compassion for you. It doesn't mean I don't, you know, I might even like to give you a hug, but I don't do it. It's more like a spiritual hug rather than a material hug. Yeah. Look at it that way.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else like to ask a question? Eddie is always good for a question. Okay.
Ajahn Dhamali, don't you think those secular Buddhists, you know, there are people who don't know about Buddhism, you know. They might know a little bit this thing, and they make comments, you know. Well, the real Buddhist, the Buddha thought is, he asks us to look inside, you know, okay? To experience his teaching, to be awakened this thing, okay? And to, he says, he teaches suffering and the ending of suffering. That's the inside why, you know. Those so-called Buddhists, they are just like modern age, you know. They know a little bit this thing, and they have big mouth comments, you know. That's what I think.
Well, it's... Okay, sometimes that is true, I think. Sometimes that's right, but sometimes it's not the full story. Sometimes some of the secular Buddhists are actually very well educated, and sometimes they know the Buddhist teachings very well. But I think the problem with the secular Buddhists is that they come to Buddhism with prior views, with prior ideas about what is acceptable and what is not. And when you're already stuck with prior views and prior ideas, you're not able to take on board the fact that the Buddha taught these things, because your mind is already skewed. Your mind is already distorted in a certain direction. We're all like that, right? We're all blind to a certain extent. Whenever we come to something, we're all distorted by our preconceptions and pre-ideas. It has has to be like that. It can't be any different. We all have that problem. And I think that is the main problem with the secular Buddhist. And that's why it's important. Very often, they are actually very sincere people. They love to read the suttas. They love to read the word of the Buddha, trying to understand it. But I think the problem is that there is certain things they're not willing to give up. And that's why it is so hard for them to jump that hurdle, so to speak. Yeah.
Can I see?
The ones I read, it's only very shallow, you know, conventional truth. Yeah. They're good at that, you know. The Buddha teaches the ultimate truth, the real truth, you know. I think a lot of circular Buddhists, that's what I read, you know, it's just very surface.
Yeah. Yes, of course, that's true. Most of us are on the shallow level. Very few are on the level of ultimate truth, you know. It's pretty rare to find that in the world. Sometimes you find people, you find us that's tingling. There's somebody, something special about somebody, right? Sometimes you meet those monks. You might even meet them here, right, sometimes. And you meet those monks, they have something about them that is kind of slightly otherworldly, slightly different. And it kind of makes you feel, whoa, here, maybe we are in the presence of more ultimate reality. And it's very fascinating when that happens, because you react to that. You can almost feel it sometimes that it's true. Okay. Anybody else? Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay. So we have one message from overseas. So this is from Dirayupa. Hello, Dirayupa. I know her quite well, from Thailand. And getting old now, so I need to bring back up my glasses so I can see what is going on. Is there a sutta in which the Buddha expressed his view whether monks should be involved in politics? If they are allowed to do so, where is the borderline? Wow, that is a hard question to kind of to end the day on. So I think this is my take on this. The Buddha doesn't really say all that much about involvement in politics. I think in those days it was obvious that if you were a monk, you had left the world, right? Leaving the world means leaving politics behind. If you go back into politics again, you're moving back into the world, and I think you are you are losing some of that sense of being a monk or being a monastic as a consequence. But one of the important things is that to remember that everything is political at a certain level, right? It's impossible to be completely neutral about things. As soon as you open your mouth, somebody can construe what you're saying as being political one way or another. Right? If I say something about abortion, for example, right? I can give you a purely Buddhist view on abortion, purely Buddhist, and yet some people say, oh, you're being right-wing or you're being left-wing or whatever, right? And you're taking political position. No, I'm just giving you the Buddhist point of view, and you can make out of it whatever you want. So sometimes it's very hard not to be political. In a sense, people will read politics into what you say, even though you're making purely Buddhist assertions about things. So this is the first thing. The world is political, and in that sense, it's impossible to avoid it altogether. But at the same time, I think it is important for many reasons that we avoid taking deliberate political positions, whatever our personal views might be about certain issues, because Buddhism is a very broad tent, right? That should take in everybody. Everybody should be welcome, regardless of the political position, unless they have some really crazy view that, you know, it's okay to exterminate all people or something like that. Then it might be a bit more difficult to kind of accommodate them at least 100%, but maybe even then they can come in slowly, right? And we can gradually change their view, perhaps. So it should be a broad tent. And if I sit here and I kind of proclaim certain political views, it's going to turn people off. I don't really want to do that, right? There are good people on all sides of politics, whatever kind of position you have. And it is that goodness in people we need to encourage. It is that goodness that can give rise to insight and deep meditation. And this is the most important thing here. So for that reason, I think it's good not to be too involved in politics, because it turns a large number of people off. All those who oppose that point of view will be turned off if you are too involved. And also, you are really neglecting, I think, your vocation as a monastic if you do that. Anyway, that's just my kind of little bit of, on that particular topic. Yeah. So that's it. Everybody happy? Yeah? Everybody okay? Okay. That's the case. Let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami